We're coming to the end of day one. It's a penultimate session now on policy practitioners. You are change makers, you're trying to accelerate a business or an innovative idea, and you need to massively scale circular economy. So this session, the last for today, is sponsored by Monash Sustainable Development Institute, and it's an interdisciplinary impact-orientated research centre at Monash Uni, with a focus on system change, industry transition, and behaviour research. Circular economy is one of their main strategic priorities. And as part of this, and to learn from this, we've got global best practices and industry pioneers in Europe, and they've managed to recruit one of the leading academics of more than 10 years, hands-on circular economy experience at McKinsey and Cambridge University, Associate Professor Martin Geisdorfer. So Martin is going to start the session with an exciting announcement about new circular economy labs, and then this will be followed by a panel where we're going to have Jennifer Macklin moderating this panel, Courtney Holm and Lachlan Feggins joining Martin after the keynote. Please welcome Martin.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. So my name is Martin Geisdorfer, and today I want to present our new circular economy labs at Monash Sustainable Development Institute. We work in very close collaboration also with our business school. And I'm very excited to present this because on one hand I want to show you why we are so excited about this new center, but also to give you an overview a little bit what are the activities, what are the plans that we have for the center. And then we will have a short video that we have prepared about the center before we go to our panel. We have today Lachlan and Courtney, who are really pioneering business practitioners in Australia and the field, and also my colleague, our circular behavior expert, Jen Macklin. And then also you have time during the panel to ask questions if you have any questions about what I will present you now. Before I start, I want to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the country and pay my respect to their elders, past, present, and emerging. So why do we need this center? Why do we need this circular economy labs? I have put picked some figures here. What I want to emphasize was something that we heard this morning that, like, if we think about sustainability, we often think about some kind of unfinished business where we have to get better at it. Well, if we look at the numbers, we actually still work like really moving in the wrong direction when it comes to resource consumption, when it comes to emissions, when it comes to waste, and we are moving quite quickly in the wrong direction. So the reason why a lot of people are quite excited about the circular economy and why we are so excited about it is not only that it gives an opportunity to really address these issues, but at the same time, it also promises really to create jobs, to create economic value at the same time. The question is, when it's so fantastic, like what is the problem with the circular economy? And to make it short, the problem is really scale. So if you look at the scale of the circular economy, we find it's actually quite tiny compared to the linear economy. And we find it's actually shrinking as a percentage of the whole economy, because we're ramping up linear production faster than we go circular. This is even worse in Australia. Australia, we have a percentage of the economy that is circular of only 4%. And we also have one of the highest material footprints per person in the OECD, in the rich world. We know that it can be different. Like, we know that there are examples out there that work, and we know there are a lot of companies that actually do a really good job in going circular and following different strategies to do that. The problem is that it's really, like, if you look at the whole of the economy, it's just not enough. And we also see that a lot of companies are really stuck in what a colleague called pilotitis, so that really a lot of companies are stuck in a like endless cycle of pilots and not really scaling the operations up. We have talked to 100 businesses, peak bodies, and policymakers. And now the slide is not working. Can we get to the next slide? It's not working. Can you manually flip to the next one? And we found quite a range of problems that these companies face that keep them from really scaling up the operations. I have collected some here, both for an Australian perspective and a global perspective. I think in Australia, what really popped up a lot is, on the one hand, like really this, like how can you approach the topic strategically? Where do you start? Where do you find investment? Where do you find the infrastructure that you need? How do you put that in place? And then also what you have to see is that we really have circular economy size skill gap and capability gap in the country. But these are all things that we need to address. And this is exactly why we are so excited about our center that we want to put forward, because we really want to become a transition broker and address these issues. And we want to do this by cutting at research, of course, because this is really our core, but we also have a track record of working with industry to really translate this knowledge that we're generating into impact. And what is also very important is that we really look into how can we get the talent, how can we develop future leaders, both with industry, but then also, of course, with our students. It doesn't work when it's... Okay. But it's a laser pointer. Very good. So we're organized in three pillars. So on the one hand, we are a research center. So we really try to, on the one hand, put Monash, of course, but also Australia on the map when it comes to international research. Is this very European focused at the moment, and really get a rest of the world perspective into this. We are also developing, on the one hand, of course, solutions, how you can scale up these solutions with industries, but we're also developing a suite of open access tools that really make top-notch advisory in this much more accessible than we have it at the moment. We also look into policy making and policy support, where we do a range of activities, including what Jennifer is leading around circular behavior and how we can really help policymakers from a local, really through a federal level, how we can improve that and how we can get the best data and advice into these systems. And all of this is supported by capability building. So again, professional education, building capabilities with companies, and especially getting a curriculum up and running where you can develop the circular economy leaders of tomorrow. I brought three examples to make this a little bit more tangible. So the first one is a consortium that we are at the moment building, really with pioneering businesses and policymakers. They really look into how can we test assumptions, how can we test key bottlenecks that keep companies from going circular at scale. How can we have a safe space where companies can exchange experiences, how they can build capabilities. We look into how we can develop tomorrow's leaders in the field. And then we also want to get access to best practices, especially in Europe, but also globally. We also started already developing these tools. So here I brought one example, the Circularity Capabilities tool. So this is something that's based on more than 10 years of research in how we can do business model innovation, circular business model innovation, where we found that a lot of the time, it's really not the business model that's the problem, but building the ecosystem, engaging all these different partners, because you normally have a much more diverse ecosystem, much more governance, much more coordination necessary. We are quite excited that we actually have a first, we run it with a few companies, and we're already at a point where one of these groups of companies went forward, is developing a business case and wants to invest in this, which proves that it's really possible to design these ecosystems deliberately from scratch, which we are very excited about. The last thing I wanted to show before we show our video is that we are also mapping the landscape going forward. What are the big topics that we want to investigate around the circular economy that we want to work on? And our university has basically tasked us to come up with a mission cross faculty, cross campuses, so also with Indonesia, Malaysia, and Europe. And this is some of the most exciting topics that we are looking at. It's really something where we map what is really the things where we are positioned in Australia to make a difference, and then how do we engage to make this difference happen. If you have any questions, we will have the panel soon. Before we go to the panel, we have prepared a short video that we want to show. So with this, can you please play a video?
Current consumption trends are not sustainable. The circular economy can be a key part of the solution, but needs to be massively scaled to fulfill its global promise. According to the OECD, global waste is projected to rise by 70% by 2050, and global raw material extraction is projected to double by 2060. However, recent CSIRO data shows that only 3.7% of the Australian economy is circular, half the global average. Australia risks falling behind in rapidly innovating global supply chains. We need to urgently accelerate the shift from an economy that is based on take and waste to one that's based on reusing and preserving value. The Monash Sustainable Development Institute has been instrumental in co-developing and implementing solutions that have created real-world impact. We have been leading the way with interdisciplinary applied research in Australia and globally.
Moving to a circular economy is one of the largest transformations of our time. It requires coordinated action towards common goals. Using our expertise in systems and behaviour change, we help shape policy, set agendas, and build narratives to deliver the real-world impact needed. Our behavioural roadmap to circular consumption, transitions, a circular textiles economy, and other collaborations with Australian, Victorian, and New South Wales governments have led to policy recommendations for narrowing, slowing, intensifying, and closing resource loops.
We plan to accelerate the business transition to a circular economy. We work closely with industry and understand challenges that industry face in adopting circular practices. To achieve this, it's important to collaborate and co-design solutions through knowledge sharing to address gaps in tools, skilled resources, as well as financial and regulatory barriers and incentives.
Scaling the circular economy to the size of the global linear economy is one of the key challenges of our time. But we have successfully taken first steps, and there's real momentum in Australia and the region.
We invite you to speak with us about how we can partner with you.
Thanks so much, Martin. As Martin mentioned, I'm Jennifer Macklin. I work for BehaviourWorks, which is part of Monash Sustainable Development Institute, and I'm the behaviour lead for Circular Economy Labs. I'm really excited by this session. So BehaviourWorks about 4 years ago sort of commenced a collaboration with the Australian, Victorian and New South Wales governments to really understand like responsible and circular consumption. How can we improve consumer behaviour? How can we actually really transform it and reduce material footprint? And what we found after a few years of this research was there's really not that much scope for consumer behaviour change in the economy as it is presently. What's really needed is major industry shift, new business models, new practices in industry, obviously supported or led by government. And so it's really my great pleasure to be here today with two leading industry practitioners that I'll introduce shortly to really talk about how we can accelerate the business transition to circular economy. And I think, as Martin said, you know, the centre is really about that collaboration. It's really about how we bring research and practice together to really accelerate that transition. So I'm going to kick off the panel with a couple of questions to really set the scene for what we want to talk about today. But then obviously I've got the iPad to get all of your questions as well. So use the app to share those questions. It's been really great, I think, to have time to actually do this interaction where we can answer your questions. But Lachlan, I'm going to start with you. You're a sustainability professional for over 20 years. You're the Senior Director for Sustainability and Regeneration at Brambles. And, you know, Brambles has been named the fourth most sustainable company in the world by Time Magazine. You might be well known to some people in the room for your reusable pallet system. What's really exciting to you about the work that Brambles is doing?
Well, first of all, the most exciting thing is this launch of the Circular Economy Lab. So congratulations. Well done to Monash. I think that's a fantastic initiative and it's something that is sorely needed within the Australian context. Now, you mentioned Brambles. Hopefully some of you know who we are. We're probably one of the largest circular businesses in the world. And we have around, just to give you an idea of scale, we're about 365 million reusable pallets, crates and containers moving through over 60 economies in the world. And that's been going on for quite some time. This is not a massively innovative thing. I've got to be fair on that. But what's exciting about this is where this is going to go. And I think that this is an Australian innovation that's actually been taken out to the world as well. So it's quite, you know, unique in that regard. But I think that some of the exciting things in the circular economy space have been touched on by the panel that just came up, the incorporation of nature into circular economy. And I think that that's something that has probably been forgotten about for quite some time. And I think that the we deal with the product in use and we deal with the product at end of life, but we're not dealing with the regeneration of those materials in the upstream value chain. And one of the areas that Brambles has been focusing on is how do we go further up the value chain? How do we get access to a secure supply of sustainable materials that we can make timber pallets from, and going right up the supply chain, but also having a really big impact socially and on biodiversity, on nature as well. So really sort of closing that loop on upstream, in-use phase and end of life. One of the other areas is technology and applying technology to our assets. You can consider a pallet a pretty dumb asset, if you like, just moving around drinks, food, all those sorts of things around the economy. You put some technology onto that and build the systems and infrastructure around that. You start to get an amazing map of supply chains and what's happening in those supply chains, what's moving those supply chains. And for us, it's really about protecting our assets, because we're not circular if we keep losing pallets or they keep getting stolen or they keep leaking out of supply chains. So with this technology, we can have this visibility that we didn't have before as to what's happening in those supply chains. And that's incredibly exciting. And it's really underpinning our 2030 strategy, which I might touch on in the next section.
Thanks, Lachlan. And we're going to go deeper into these case studies through this session. But Courtney, I'll turn to you. You're the founder and CEO of Circular Sourcing, which is a sort of a climate technology platform that's trying to, can't get my head around this, revalue the $82 billion worth of surplus textiles globally, really trying to equip businesses with a B2B marketplace that allows those with surplus textiles to sell them at scale, which is really exciting. So connecting them to buyers and actually making access to circular economy revenue. So it's not just about the environmental impact. It is, as we, you know, hear, it's about the economic as well as the environment. So tell us about the shift that you're trying to create.
Yeah, for sure. So we hear a lot about clothing waste and, you know, pre-consumer waste or post-consumer waste being clothes, but we're really focused on the raw material pre-consumer stuff. And it's kind of like a hidden waste crisis. No one speaks about it. And yet 20% of all textiles that are made don't end up being used or sold as originally intended. So really the shift for us was about how do we actually use this material and what are the barriers that are currently being faced by the businesses that hold these materials or have the materials sitting in their supply chains to stop them from actually getting this material used either by them or by someone else. So Circular Sourcing started through ABCH, which was a circular fashion label, and up until the start of this year was my full-time focus. And we actually did a pilot, which was co-funded by Sustainability Victoria. And that pilot allowed us to test the market, build an MVP platform, and do a 12-week pilot with the Australian industry to see if there was an appetite really for businesses to list their material and for businesses to purchase them. So it's a marketplace, it's a supply and demand. So there's those two sides of it. And we ran a pilot last year, a 12-week pilot, and we put 5 tons of textiles through the platform with no marketing, very little funding, running off the smell of an oily rag, you know, very scrappy. And we saw immediately the potential for this platform, not just within Australia, but within the Asia Pacific region. So Circular Sourcing is now my full-time focus and is an early stage startup. And yeah, that's really what we're trying to do, is to kind of shine a light on these materials. And not just that, but these materials typically get devalued as soon as the first kind of cutting is done, or as soon as the production is over, or if they don't sell, or if they're the wrong color. There's all sorts of reasons why materials are created as surplus, but it's kind of the status quo. Like, it's just a part of business. And so we were really interested in, what do we how do we actually take these materials and revalue them, actually move them up the resource and waste hierarchy? So instead of them sitting down in that kind of, you know, very low destruction, recycle sort of stage, how do we actually realize their value, use our technology platform to show how beautiful and how interesting these materials are, and actually get fashion and textile designers excited about using them, and then to kind of push them up that resource hierarchy, up into that reuse space, and build value for the people that have the material. So like you said, actually bring some incentive to the supply side of it, and actually bring some equity to the supply chain in that process, as well as provide these materials to businesses that actually really are interested and want to use them. So it's really just connecting those two things together.
And I think what's really great about this is to kind of see the comparison between, you know, really established business model that's continuing to push the boundaries, continuing to look for those shifts that need to happen, and kind of really identifying a specific challenge that you want to solve. But Martin, I'll throw it over to you because you have been working on circular economy in Europe before it was cool. You helped with setting the direction of some of the, you know, first European Commission research programs. You've worked with Fortune 500 companies, you know, who wanted to kind of go circular from scratch. So you've seen a lot. What are some of the changes that that you've seen that is exciting you?
I think there's a lot of exciting things happening in the space. I think on a macro level, you can really see that circular economy came from a niche topic in the policy realm to really a strategic topic for a lot of companies. And we see the EU Circular Economy Action Plan and these kind of large-scale frameworks that really look how you can put resource productivity at the focus of a lot of industry policy and a lot of like important like guidelines, European guidelines and national guidelines. I think in Australia especially, we have a lot of momentum. Like we saw the CMEC with John this morning, like what is happening there, that we also get a national framework. We saw Minister Blibersek like really supporting this concept. So I think it's really, there's a lot of momentum in Australia. And we know from our network of campuses in Indonesia and Malaysia, and also we work with some people in Vietnam, that there's basically in the whole region, there's a lot of momentum now happening. On a corporate level, I think there's a big shift. When I started out my career, circular economy was basically an operations topic that somebody down the line would look into how we can like put this into operations. Now it's really becoming a board level topic. So we work, for example, with a industrial conglomerate in Europe that really from scratch looked into like how could our circular economy strategy look like? How can we implement it and really diligently implement it across divisions? But really as a board level topic, I think it also scratches on what we heard on a policy level, that it cannot be like a CSO or the chief sustainability officer that puts it forward, but it has to be across functions to work really. But what else is exciting? I think another like upcoming exciting thing is if you really look into, on one hand, ecosystems that we are increasingly better at designing them, as I showed earlier, but also all these technologies coming up, for example, large language models that really, if you look at circular ecosystem, it really allows you to identify where different waste products you can use, how you can coordinate between different actors, that will really get us a big step forward. And today we heard about the risks of energy, clean energy becoming cheaper. But for the circular economy, of course, there's also a big chance if we see the solar energy price, for example, they drop much quicker than we had anticipated. So this again can unlock a lot of circular operations that become commercially viable through this.
Thanks, Martin. And I think because what we're here for this afternoon is, I think, you know, we were all convinced before we turned up and heard Yana's really, eye-opening kind of statistics, but we need change, right? And so this afternoon session is really about, you know, how can we help you guys understand how to create that change and how to create that change at scale and as fast as we really need to do it. So what we want to do is dive into these case studies a little bit to show kind of the mechanics behind this change that's been creating. So Courtney, I'll turn to you first this time. I guess I'm really interested in, you know, who are those players that matter for circular sourcing? Like whose behavior did you need to change? The practices did you need to shift for circular sourcing to work?
It's a great question. So really, because it's that two-sided sort of marketplace, we needed to do both at the same time, look at both of those actors. And initially, it was about us trying to get the supply onto our platform and digitize these materials, take them out of the dusty warehouse and put them into a place where people could actually browse them and source these materials. And so there was a bit of, initial effort in explaining the platform when it didn't yet exist to future suppliers, to kind of get them to pull out these samples and send them to us. And literally some of the people that we've worked with, we've had to go there to the factory and literally cut the samples so that we could photograph them and get the data from them. But that's starting to become a bit more of a like well-working machine now, and people can just do it themselves automatically through our platform. And then the buying side is a little bit easier, because there are already businesses out there that are very interested in using surplus because it's got a great story typically. And because, especially with fashion labels, there can be such great sort of communication with customers about this being limited edition materials or tapping into local manufacturing or the story or the history of these materials. So we're really, in terms of getting that behavior changed, it's probably more just a continuing the momentum that's already happening in that sustainable fashion space, where people are really looking for solutions for how that they can engage with more sustainable sourcing and practices. So that's just been kind of more of a natural one. But yeah, it's going to be always a bit of a balance over time. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's really interesting, because what we're kind of hearing is like multiple audiences. So you've got the sellers, and you mentioned some of the barriers that need to overcome there, but you've also got the buyers. And we were talking before, and you were talking about the multiple different people in those organizations. So it's not just about getting a business leader, or a business owner, to be like, oh yeah, this is cool, I want to do this. You've got the designers. Can you tell us about, I guess, some of that interplay within these organizations, the systems inside the organization that kind of need to change?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes it's driven by the kind of head of sustainability. Other times it's one designer who's just really passionate about this, about a project. So, but really you need buy-in from multiple, especially larger brands, you need buy-in from multiple internal stakeholders. So you need the sourcing, you need the procurement planning, you need marketing, you need the design. So it's really important that these are all speaking to each other in order to use these materials. And because they're surplus, there are challenges around is this material, does it need to be retested? Does it have testing still attached to it? Like, do we need to spend more money on going out and doing these extra things? And so there's like challenges like that to overcome as well. But that's stuff that we're really interested in continuing to help support our sellers and buyers with over time.
Yeah. So it sounds like part of the work that you've done has been really understanding what are those challenges and how can you help those challenges, solve those challenges.
I'm just really curious about what those two sides, like what will make their lives easier and how will they be able to engage in this process? Because it's so inefficient that these materials are created in the first place, and we really need to get much better at inventory management in the fashion and textile space just in across the board. But I'm really interested in what are the barriers for each of those actors and how can we support them, and what do we, like, not just trying to push the marketplace solution, but like what are the actual things that we can do ourselves to make that happen. And just being really curious and constantly seeking that feedback is so important in an early stage startup as well, that you are so connected to your customer.
Thanks, Courtney. And Lachlan, you mentioned you're obviously at a very different point in the journey, but really interested, I guess, to understand, the shift that has been brought about through Brambles. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Look, I think given that we're an established circular business, some of the fundamentals, the boring fundamentals of having a circular product is that if you want people to use your product and share that product with the next participant, it needs to be standardized. All right. So that's one of the things. It needs to be standardized. If you're talking about physical products, that's why, say, Kip Cup is such a successful product as well. It's a standard product. It's a cup. It's a standard volume. These are really important things. And with that standardization, the whole logistics system is actually built around that. The truck sizes, the racking systems, all that standardization actually is really, really critical to get acceptability and use in that circular system. The other thing is network. And I think might have been Heath in the last session mentions regional networks where things can be repaired and returned. That's absolutely critical to operating a circular business. So if we're issuing product to customers and then we're trying to get that back as well, we need to have a distributed network of service centers that can receive that product, inspect it, repair it, replace the timber boards, whatever it needs to happen, recondition, wash the crates, whatever it might be, and get it back out to customers as quickly as possible. So that network is absolutely fundamental. And then you need customers, of course. And this is where I think the commercial team in our business is really quite smart with how they go about this, because they have a systems view of the value chain. I think Martin mentioned, you know, we don't do that particularly well in Australia, but when you're trying to get acceptability of a circular product right through a value chain, not one particular player, you have to find that the most influential player in that space. And in within Australia, when you're dealing with fast moving consumer goods, it's the retailer, right? So, you know, the Coles, the Woolworths, the Aldis, they're the ones who can say, these are the sorts of packaging systems that we would like to accept. You know, there's no waste for them because they, you know, dealing with, you know, lots and lots of cardboard. Talk about hidden crisis in the B2B supply chain. Cardboard is a hidden crisis. So when you've got that acceptability, what the commercial teams can do is then they can use that leverage, that big lever, to go through the value chain and actually convince the other players and say, hey, let's try a reusable platform and see if we can actually get that accepted into that supply chain. And I think that's when you're trying to get maximum usability, reusability, durability with a product, those sorts of systems are really fundamental.
And I think that's really interesting because, you know, as a contrast to kind of Courtney's example, you know, you really are talking about the ecosystem because you're not just talking about your customer and their customers, but you're also talking about your own suppliers and your service providers, like repairers. Like there's an entire system. It's not just a service or a product that you're offering and the people who are taking it off you. You actually have to change all of that. It's really interesting to hear about trying to find leverage points in the system. So looking at the whole thing and saying, where can you intervene to get the change across the whole? And I think as a behavioral science scientist, I can't help but hear both of these challenges as behavior change challenges. You know, there are people in business or in like whole supply chains, and you need them to do something differently. And that's kind of the first step of like doing behavior change is actually to identify a particular audience. And in this case, I think it's really clear that for circular economy, business is a really key audience. But then you need to work out what it is that you actually want them to do and be really specific about what you want them to do, not what you want them to stop or to avoid. You know, it's not about the problem. It is really about what is the thing that they're going to do that's going to help solve the problem. And then once you're really clear on that, once you know, okay, we need sellers to identify and hold on to their surplus and then list it on the platform. You know, once you're really clear about that, you then go in and look at those barriers or those drivers. And it's interesting to hear, you know, that if you're looking at one really specific problem, but trying to transform a whole industry, you know, you really need to get that depth of understanding of the barriers. But, you know, conversely, if you're thinking about a system, you're thinking, what's driving that whole system? How can you actually intervene? What's going to drive change? And then coming up with those interventions or those solutions. But what's really important is that those solutions match the barriers and drivers that you've identified. So if you identify that the barriers to what you want to occur are systemic, then the interventions need to be systemic as well. And I think, you know, we can really hear that in the kind of the case studies is we're not really talking about kind of traditional behavior change, you know, like information and marketing kind of, you know, communications campaigns here. We're not trying to educate and persuade people to do the environmentally sustainable thing. You know, Courtney, you're talking about, you know, much broader behavior change tools like enablement, like actually making it easy for people to do the thing that you want them to do, or environmental restructuring, fundamentally changing the environment, you know, the materials, the objects, that standardization so that the entire system kind of has to change around it. And I think that's really clear if we're thinking about circular economy and we're thinking about the speed at which we need this transition to happen. We can't kind of get locked into thinking about behavior change and behaviors and persuasion and, you know, encouraging people to do the environmentally sustainable thing. We really need to kind of look at that systemic change. How can we intervene in the system and change the system so that the behaviors within the system will also change? Now, I love behavioral science. I think it's really practical. You know, there's kind of like four key steps: the audience, the behaviors, the barriers, solutions. There's structured processes to help you think clearly about these changes that you need. But there is that trap to kind of get locked into the things that we know how to do, how to educate, or, you know, try and raise awareness or persuade people. And so it's just one tool. It's just one perspective. But Martin, I know you have a very different perspective, and I'd be really interested to hear, like, how would you reinterpret these changes, you know, in terms of like the transitions, the kind of the major shifts that we need?
I think from a transitions perspective, I think you mentioned already an important concept that we talked about, and I think you had some very good examples of this. This is the ecosystem. So from a transition perspective, it's really important, as you said, to get the behavior of really a broad range of stakeholders aligned. And the ecosystem is really a tool that can help us understand how that works in a transition context. So I think this is very, very important and very clear. I think one, maybe just to add one concept that I think is quite important that I read from what you said, is the concept of the transition broker to make this happen. And I think you are good examples for transition brokers like currently even the textiles industry and then also Brambles by providing all this rental equipment and enabling other companies to build these ecosystems. I think this is really important and very practical speaking. We have to understand, like, we see these ecosystems emerging and we see them in the real world, but we really need to work together to get more of these ecosystems, to enable transition brokers to build these ecosystems, but also to understand how that works so that we proactively can build them. Because in a lot of like, we, for example, worked at Cambridge with a plastic lid producer for Tesco's. So they had a completely circular product. I think it was 95%. Recycled materials, because 5% have to be virgin because of food regulation. It was 100% recyclable. And they asked us, how can we come up with a new business model? And basically, if you look at the business model, you couldn't see it because they just got recycled materials, pressed it, and then like got it out of to Tesco. And so you really have to look into the ecosystem to see the magic. And that's really where we need to get better. And how do we design these ecosystems proactively rather than just hoping by doing what we always do, that they create themselves organically.
Would you guys like to comment in terms of how you see yourself in what Martin's talking about?
I think the ecosystem piece is really critical. I think that's exactly how we work. It's a share and reuse ecosystem. And if you have the more participants you have within that ecosystem, the more efficient it actually is. One of the things that I think that, you know, to touch on what you were saying about behavior change, is that we do actually use a lot of sustainability related materials to convince customers to transition over into the broader ecosystem, a lot of it being, you know, increasing efficiencies. And you want to move product, you don't want to own pallets and own the waste associated with this. Let us deal with that. We'll move your product for you. And I think that those compelling sustainability narratives are actually what is helping this business and this model grow more and more. You're saving carbon, you're saving waste, you're saving water. All those narratives are really drawing more players into that ecosystem because they have these objectives themselves. They want to be more circular. This is an easy way for linear business models to become more circular, is just to start to share those resources. So a huge amount of potential within the Australian network to do this much, much better.
But Lachlan, because, you know, Courtney talked about the economic value, but because you're not just providing sustainability value, you're also providing, you know, like you talked about, labour savings. Like, there's other benefits as well. There's co-benefits.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, some there's been some value change which we have not been successful in. And I think that one of the, we're trying to move into the fast food space. And one of the most compelling components there was that you didn't have your, you know, junior employees having to go out and unpack a cardboard box, pull out the lettuce for the rolls, pack down the cardboard box, take it out to the compactor, and all that time adds up. And the compactor might be, you know, 15 minutes down in the shopping center. And so the actual, one of the more compelling narratives was actually around employee productivity and safety as well. And then you had the sustainability, you know, icing on the top. So I think that when you can package up a solution that has a huge amount of business value, broad business value, that's going to be successful. You can't sell sustainability on its own. It's got to be packaged up. And I think that that's something that the business has done quite well.
things. And so this is the idea, right? If you want to create change, it's what's really going to drive that change. And for most of us, it is the circular economy. It is the sustainability, the environmental imperative that drives us. But finding the drivers for the people that we need to make this change for industry, it's not always going to be the same narrative. And I think that's really interesting and really coming clear from the case studies that you have. I'm just looking at some of the questions that we have here. One of these for you, Martin, if Australia is behind, a little bit, at least in some of these statistics, what are some of the lessons that you might be able to impart from your international experience?
What we also heard, like part of Australia is very much behind. There's this other part that practices circular economy with country for thousands of years. And I think in Australia, that's really something we should be inspired by, how the First Nations do that. I think when we look very practical and like what companies struggle with going circular, it's normally two things. It's on one end, where to start, and then how to scale up. And where to start is really, are there very different strategies that you can use. Like, and it really depends whether you develop technologies and products, whether you have initiatives or projects, or whether you develop entirely new business models, are completely different approaches. And that really needs to be aligned with your strategy of your company. And we really have to be very thoughtful about that. And then, of course, you have to assemble the right team. You have to look into change management, because these processes often go like between marketing and sustainability and commercial and across these functions. And you often have to work against silos in this context. And then scaling up, I think a lot of companies find it even harder. And as I said before, a lot of companies also fall into this pilotitis that they perpetually create new pilots and not scale their core business. For example, we work with a European sportswear manufacturer who have a really nice circular operation within their home country. And I think it's quite a good operations, and it's really good how they build the ecosystem around it. But at the same time, 97% of their production is in Asia. And it's really hard for these companies to take the leap and to bet the company on this. Not only because of the commercials are unclear in this, but also because the level of control that you have of some of these big Asian manufacturers. We often think of them as like this command and control, but some of them are actually can call the shots on a lot of these European and Australian and American companies. So we really have to work with them, with these manufacturers, build lighthouse projects in Asia to really see like what is the risk involved, what are the commercials involved, to really then enable them, but also other industries to see what is the risk. So for Australian companies, I think like really be very strategic about how you go about it. Be really clear about what kind of strategic approach you have. Get the right team in place, get the right change measure in place, and then really prioritize these lighthouse projects to see what is possible and to get a good feel what is actually the risk and the level of control that you have. And we found that often the risk is actually much less, but the level of control is also much less.
But I think your first point too is really really good reminder to myself and the audience. Like it's really common to kind of hear this, Australia's behind. Like if you think about the regulation in Europe or in Japan, and the regulation that we have in Australia, and feeling like we need to play catch up. But we heard this morning about so many innovations actually in Australia, but it's kind of that commercialization or implementation or scale. We've got one great example, Lachlan, as you said, an Australian innovation that is now kind of global, and I guess that's the thing, is that there might be parts of what Australia is trying to do, which is kind of learn and leapfrog, from international experience. But really, we do have so much innovation and so much drive already happening in Australia. And so, I'd actually be really interesting in the lessons that you could share. So Lachlan, if there are people in the audience who are in business who have an idea or a pilot or a product or a service, a circular product or service that they're trying to really scale. Like, do you have any lessons that you might share to them?
Yeah, I think that the B2C world is incredibly challenging to do circularity in. I don't know if you're probably just above the C component, but I've seen a lot of startups go that direction and not get to where you need to, because you need scale, you need participation, and all those sorts of things. I see there's a lot of, not to say that there's not opportunity there. I think there absolutely is. Huge opportunity within the B2B world, but this is where government needs to set the rules in a different way. And I think that, if Australia's 4% circular, it's a pretty bad scorecard. And, just as an example, there was a recent submission opportunity for the federal government to talk about packaging reform within Australia. And, we were scrambling with our limited resources, even though we're a large company, we're still very scrambling. It's like, we've got to get a submission in because no one was talking about reuse. There was no mention of it in the entire submission. And you've heard Courtney talk about that valorization of the material further up the hierarchy. That still hasn't sunk in. And it was all about let's deal with the problem, end of pipe recycling. So we had to put a submission in saying, yes, recycling absolutely critical and necessary, but also there's a lot of reuse opportunities here that I think you could actually benefit a lot of different companies. And I think that the way you can incentivize that is through eco-modulation, where, the best practice is really standardized and measured against a benchmark, and all other competing options are measured against that. And that eco-modulation means that if you're less sustainable, less reusable, less recycled, you're going to pay more for that packaging on the market. Whereas if you're, reusable, multiple reuse, you're going to pay a lot less. And I think that incentive from government is really critical if we're going to move beyond that 4%.
But I think... if we're talking like we've definitely heard the need for regulation and we've heard that there is recommendations coming out of the CMAG for some of that. But I think that thought about, again, this audience, like who do you target is really interesting. You mentioned like B2B, business to business. So if you have an idea, if you have an offering, like who are you targeting for that offering? Because it's also one of the things that comes out of our research around, again, behavior change, but behavior change for business is sometimes easier to achieve because making the case for change, businesses are not rational entities any more than individual people are rational entities, but they do have some processes that respond well to rational arguments, to the economic kind of benefits that can come, or, some of the bigger businesses who now have ESG reporting requirements and things like that. Making the case for change sometimes with B2B can actually be easier to do than, talking to individual consumers. And so that's a really interesting thing that if you're trying to create change from outside a business, but targeting businesses as your audience rather than targeting individuals is really interesting. And I guess, Courtney, that's kind of what you've done. So, I mean, you are in the industry, but this is not your own problem that you're trying to solve. You kind of saw a problem and you're trying to now create a kind of a solution. So again, if you were talking to people in the audience who are looking at a problem that they want to solve, do you have like lessons that you've learned, I wish I'd known, kind of moments that you could share from your experience so far?
I definitely resonate with the kind of B2B impact as opposed to B2C, coming from a fashion label background where we were B2C. I can absolutely see how you can create much more impact if you are B2B. And that's really what my focus is now through what I do. But I think businesses, especially in the fashion and textile space, businesses are really looking for solutions because of the regulatory pressure that's coming from the EU. And I mean, hopefully eventually we have something similar and aligned within Australia, but those businesses are looking for circular economy solutions. And I agree, there is such a huge opportunity in those kind of our strategy, circular business models that are really untapped. And there is a huge future for creativity in those spaces. And even when we talk about like design and the amount of kind of fashion designers coming through university and these kinds of things, there's so many opportunities in those, in the reuse space, in that remanufacture. But we also need to support this manufacturing industry locally as well in the fashion and textile space. So there's a lot of kind of infrastructure and systems that need to go alongside that. So it's an exciting space, but it's all kind of having to happen at the same time, the system and also the operators.
Thanks, Courtney. Just looking at some of these questions, there's some really specific questions, some really strong interest in circular sourcing. People might want to come up and ask Courtney a little bit more about that. But at a higher level, one of these questions come up is this idea about if you're trying to get this business change, how do you get buy-in at the exec or the board level? Someone's commented that often not even the financial advantages of operating more sustainably are winning over board members, and that's kind of the senior exec. So Martin and Lachlan, perhaps, do you have comments?
Yeah, absolutely. That was exactly the situation we faced. You know, when I've been at Brambles for nearly 9 years now, and it wasn't a thing that we were focusing on at that particular point. And we had the boss was from the US, and you know, the only green he cared about was the greenback. That's what he used to say. Demonstrate to me that this is something that will work. And we said, okay, well, customers want this, and we were able to demonstrate the customers. They want waste reduction, they want carbon reduction, they want circularity. And we were able to get some really big, you know, global brands on board and putting their sustainability decision-making criteria right at the top of their procurement decision and demonstrating that they were putting their money where their mouth is, and it differentiated us out in the market. And so that value proposition of the customer is absolutely critical to winning over the board, winning over the executive. We did the same thing for investors. We said this: we want to attract more ESG investors. So we developed an investor value proposition and went out and started to build. And it's very difficult to tell who isn't an ESG investor a lot of the time. But we built that trajectory up by doing a lot of research on our share registry. And I think that value proposition in terms of what can we do for you that's different to where you can put your money or where you can compete in terms of moving your goods through the supply chain was incredibly critical to actually winning over the executive and the board. And the one that we never even tried to do anything around, which to be honest is probably one of the most powerful things within the business at the moment, is the talent. And we never sought to do this explicitly, but because we've been, as you mentioned, you know, ranked by Time Magazine, the fourth most sustainable company in the world. I'll probably change the methodology next year, so we could be right down the bottom, who knows. But the people want to work for a purpose-led company. They want to work for something that is making change that's beyond, you know, what they're doing in the day-to-day. And I think that when we have new people come to the organization, they say they're coming because they want to work for a sustainable organization. They stay because they want to stay with a sustainable organization. And that talent attraction and retention, that's huge value for any organization, especially, you know, a couple of years ago when the labor market was incredibly tight. So customers, investors, employees, the value is there. That's compelling. Each one of those individually is compelling, but together it's really powerful.
Thanks, Lachlan. Martin?
I fully agree with everything you said. Like in my experience, it's really, there are different ways how these transitions can be successful. And like one thing, and it's very similar to what we discussed about business to customer versus business to business businesses, that actually a good starting point is often if you have a customer who wants it. And that happens quite a lot, especially in Europe now, where we have these green industries that really proactively ask their suppliers to come up with solutions. So that can be a very strong force. And a lot of the models that we see out in the wild actually came from a customer demanding it and then the company setting in place. There's also, and I think we have, again, good examples for that, if you have champions in the company, and then these champions have to be, like, they have to get the right numbers. So they have to prove the case that this is actually viable. And then they have to build the right coalition of the willing and get other functions. So we saw a few examples where if you have it from the chief sustainability officer, it might be not as successful if you have the like other functions on board and then really propose it together. The other thing that we often forget in the debate is that we actually have, even with large companies, we have intrinsically motivated companies and decision makers. We often, there's not even a question whether they want to go ahead with a circular model, but we just about the how. And that, of course, then is a very good starting point to make this happen.
And I've lost our timekeeping, but I think we're coming close to the end. So I just one more question, Martin, which kind of follows on from this B2B question about opportunities is kind of, do you see there being any really key sectors of interest specifically for the Circular Economy Labs is the question, but I think also just more broadly in terms of like, where are the opportunities that, you know, we could be focusing on to create change?
There's a lot of good questions, good answers for this question. I think there's on one end, there's an answer about like, what is Australia strong in? And we had been in contact with the mining industry, with the pharma industry, with agriculture. So these are really things where like we often talk about manufacturing, but it is not necessarily where Australia is particularly strong, but we have very strong industries and we are working with them. And I think this is a very important starting point. The other answer that I can give is, of course, what we heard before. It's what is visible. So if we have plastics, if we have consumer goods, like these are, I think textiles is a very good example. And we have our colleague, Alicia, who will present tomorrow as well. Like this is really, there's a lot of visibility and it's very important that we get the right cases in. And then what I think is also really crucial, like for the scale up that we mentioned, that we really look into what are industries where we have this later Western led, but have this big scale, this large scale production in Southeast Asia, and then work together with these, but also with really the manufacturers in Southeast Asia. And we see that there's a lot, for example, we work a lot with Vietnamese partners and they have these big Taiwanese owned manufacturing companies that are actually quite interested in that, but that really want to see what are the commercials behind it. These are the kind of industries we work with. And there's a lot of momentum. Like you sometimes seem a bit like you hear about a bit doom and gloom about Australia and the kind of manufacturing especially that we have. But there's a lot of really impactful companies and sectors. Just one figure I heard recently about, and I don't know if it's correct, but opioids, like really if you look at bio-based pharmaceuticals, Australia is actually one of the largest manufacturers in the whole world. I heard around 80% or so of opioids actually being produced in Australia. So that is quite impressive.
Thanks, Martin. But I think that's the thing is this idea about, you know, rethinking where are the opportunities. I don't know if that's an opportunity we were quite aware of for now. But to wrap us up, I guess, you know, I'm really interested, you know, in these kind of changes that you're making. And, you know, this panel is about, you know, how can we accelerate kind of the business transition to circular economy? So, you know, some final words that you'd like to leave us with, Courtney.
So I'm really interested in how we link the impact of these surplus materials to like link them together. So embodied carbon, embodied water, and actually are able to see what that impact is, because when we can see that, we can take action. So I think having metrics, having as much information and data about these materials, whether it's pallets or textiles or opioids, I guess, I think that the more data and information we can have attached to these materials, we will be able to make better decisions around them.
Thanks, Courtney.
Look, I'm going to stay on that metrics line as well. I think that's absolutely critical. And look, a lot of you in the audience are going to be designing your 2030 strategies at the moment in terms of what are you going to be doing for your next 5 years. Look, for Brambles, circularity is absolutely at the core of that. And the reason if your circularity is your business strategy, you're going to be addressing climate, you're going to be addressing nature by definition if you're being circular. And I think that is a business strategy which I'd love more organizations to adopt far more rapidly. So I'm happy to share anything that we can to help any organization move along that path a lot faster. The measurement piece is critical. I think that there's a new ISO standard, circularity, performance and measurement. Yay, who would have thought there'd be one of those around? But when there's an ISO standard that we can point to and start to actually benchmark circular measurement, that's really exciting. So this is something I think that we're going to start to look at. And it can, from what I understand, is adaptable from an organization, you know, to a facility, to a product. And it can really answer those questions about the embodied carbon, the embodied water, and the embodied impact of different materials. And I think that that's going to be really valuable for us in terms of being a more efficient, more circular business, but also the benefit and the value for the customers and the broader supply chain are going to also, you know, tap into that benefit.
Thanks, Lachlan. Martin?
I think it's now more than 10 years since the Ellen MacArthur Foundation reports and where it like really took momentum, the circular economy concept. And actually a lot of what we see is quite incremental, and I think there's a real risk here. But at the same time, we saw the momentum we have in Australia and around the world. So we really should see how we can use this momentum more. We can work better together to really scale the circular economy to the size of the linear economy. And I think there's a real opportunity and real momentum, but it's also quite exciting.
And I think for me, the key takeaway, you know, when I hear this is this question about, okay, there's a lot of change that we need, you know, but there's a whole system that we have to consider. And that idea about where in the system can you intervene? Where are you best placed, you know, to intervene? And where do we need to see the change? Because, you know, the thing that, you know, startled us so much when we did this research on circular consumption, how do we get consumers to consume more responsibly, to buy and use products more responsibly. The answer was to have government mandate minimum durability standards, design and import standards for products. That was the answer that came out of this research. It wasn't about what consumers did. It wasn't even about what businesses did, because the barriers and the systems that are operating against consumers and businesses to really scale are so massive that what is needed in this particular case is government intervention. And so looking at the problem at the system and saying, where do we need the change? Where can we intervene? And what tools can we bring for that systemic intervention? Which stakeholders can we engage to have further change in that system? I think to me, it is this, you know, if we want to accelerate that business transition, it's really looking at that whole system, at the ecosystem, and saying, how do we get change across that? So thanks for keeping with us, the last session of the afternoon. Maria, I hand back to you.
What a session. That was fantastic. I mean, I could just talk to you guys all night. So thank you. Congratulations on the Monash Circular Economy Lab launch. And I think there'll be a lot of customers and clients. Thanks for sharing your experience as well. So thank you.